Welcome to the next edition of the Patika Wealth Management Group's Speaker Series. This is John Patika Jr. here coming from you from Clearwater, Florida. And today's discussion will be on the state of U.S. politics. We've got our senior member of our team here, John Patika Sr., and a special guest today. His name's John Savercole, and he's our senior lobbyist and managing director of UBS Americas. He directs our firm's lobbying, political, and policy advocacy efforts at the federal level. He manages a small staff up in Washington to support this mission. He's worked with U.S. Congressman Mike Oxley out of Ohio, Phil Graham out of Texas, and U.S. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson back in 1993. And in 2003, John was selected by UBS to become the firm's first full-time senior lobbyist to direct the firm's advocacy efforts up in Washington. And he manages the firm's political relationships up there as well. So, John, welcome to the call.
Thank you, John. It's really nice to be on the call with you.
John, this is John Sr. I'm going to get right to it. We like to try to keep these to around a half hour. So first question, I've known you a long time, John, and you're nothing like the evil villain portrayed in the movies. So maybe you can first talk a little bit about how a political action committee works, how lobbyists work, so on, then give our clients a little understanding of this.
Sure, John, and I've really enjoyed our interaction over the years and hopeful that they'll continue for many more years. A lobbyist basically is a salesperson for whomever you represent. I happen to work for UBS, so I represent UBS's interests in Washington. And what that means is laws and regulations that we care about. Usually we strongly support them or strongly oppose them or seek changes in them to make them more reasonable. Those are things that I advocate on a daily basis. So I talk to lawmakers, I talk to regulators, I have a UBS view that I try to communicate to them. Hopefully it's persuasive, and hopefully it will result in a law or a regulation that we believe is fair for not only our company, but our clients as well. So I spend a lot of my day learning about some of the challenges that our business has related to laws and regulations. And then I go to lawmakers and regulators and talk to them about that. A political action committee is a part of what we do. It helps us get to know lawmakers better. It allows us to support lawmakers who we believe are pro-business in nature and want to help a company like ours achieve fair regulatory and tax policy. So that's basically how I spend my day, mostly talking to people and in the process highlighting the company's efforts and what we do with clients and why we're valuable in the market, and try to educate members about what UBS is all about, and then try to persuade them to our positions on certain laws and regulations. And that's really the day of a lobbyist in Washington, D.C.
Well, I know also that once in a while you'll take a little heat for giving money to a politician and might not be popular to some of my colleagues. Maybe you can talk about that, you need to talk to both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, so when we become engaged politically, which we do through our PAC, we give to both Republicans and Democrats. The common denominator that we try to find is we try to support members that maybe have a business background or who focus on securities, investment, banking issues, and who have some knowledge of those issues. So we try to support those that we believe are fair and balanced. And, you know, we never know which party is going to be in power. So we have to have relationships with both parties, with leaders of both parties. And so we support those that we think have a reasonable view on most business issues. Occasionally, we are questioned about whether we support members based on their positions on social issues. And a lot of those social issues are prominent in the media today. But the answer is we don't. We don't really take into account their view on whether they're pro-life or pro-choice or whether they are for certain electoral reforms or not. We base them solely on their position on the business issues that are important to our bottom line.
Thanks. Glad we wanted to make sure I brought that up. Another little maintenance thing that we had a debate around here. Hopefully you can shed light on it. If the president doesn't make it through his term and the vice president gets put into power either from death or whatever they might do to put her in, what is the process to select a new vice president? How does that work?
Well, the new president, the current vice president, would pick a person, and that person would be a part of the remainder of the. So that's what the new vice president would not need any kind of confirmation by the Senate, require a vote with the public, but it would be the prerogative of the new president to select a vice president.
That was the question, really, is if it needed any kind of confirmation. So you cleared that up.
Yes. Yes, it does not.
Okay. Okay. So Congress is in session right now. I know they have recesses coming up. What are they working on? Are they going to get anything done? What's going on up there?
Well, so Congress is in session for most of July. Right now, they're working on a lot of different things. But the two bills that will likely become law at some point. One is a technology bill that increases U.S. funding for science and tech research. This is all done because there's a concern that China is ahead of us in certain areas. And the pandemic over the last couple of years has taught us and taught lawmakers that we can't be dependent on nations that we're not friendly with for certain materials like semiconductors. So this bill spends about $200 billion, a lot of money, on science and tech research, and then it spends another $50 billion on the establishment of semiconductor facilities around the U.S. Right now, the U.S. only makes about 12% of the global semiconductor market, and with the establishment of these facilities, that level would go way up. So there's a desire not to be dependent on foreign suppliers of semiconductors, which are basically in everything that moves, except for bodies, human bodies. But everything else, cars, trains, airplanes, fighter jets, things like that, all require semiconductors. They're very important. So this bill would increase funding in that regard. The only bad thing is that the money wouldn't be offset, so it would be added to the budget deficit. It wouldn't be paid for by cutting other federal spending, which seems to be the way that Congress operates these days. They spend a lot of money, but they never pay for the bills. The second big bill is the Democrats' Build Back Better bill. I don't know if people are that familiar with that. It was probably President Biden's biggest legislative priority when he was elected. The House passed a bill late last year that spent a little under $2 trillion on a wide range of new social spending, and they offset some of that with tax increases on wealthier individuals and businesses. And that has been what Democrats have tried to pass for the last year, but it's run into a roadblock in the Senate. Some Democratic senators, including Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, has insisted that it be much smaller, that he believes that inflation is caused by excessive federal spending. So he's put the brakes on that bill. And right now, the bill, the final bill, will very, very likely not contain any tax increases. So no tax increases on our clients just because they have the fortune of having money with us or a certain amount of money. So no new taxes on individuals, no new taxes on businesses. What will happen is that they'll make some reforms to prescription drug pricing within Medicare that will save the government some money, and they'll use that savings to extend healthcare subsidies under Obamacare. Democrats will pass this with 50 votes. Democrats are the majority party, so that's why I mention them so much. So I think these two bills, the technology bill and the smaller Build Back Better bill, will likely pass before early August, and Congress will then go on its summer break. And that will be basically what they pass before the election. And Democrats want to add these bills to their resume so they can tout them to voters and, in their minds, hopefully appeal to voters in the upcoming elections.
Well, I guess that's a great segue. Let's just do it. Midterm elections, what, like 3 months away? What do you see? What are you thinking?
Well, you know, 3 months away from election day, but in those states where there's early voting up to a month before the election will start in 2 months. So the election will be on our doorstep literally after the August break, after our summer vacations in August. Typically, when a party controls, it usually, when a president is elected, his party doesn't do so well 2 years later in the first midterm elections. In fact, in the last 100 years, there's only been three incidents where a sitting president's party has won seats in the following midterm elections. I expect this year to be no different. All the momentum right now is with the Republicans, not so much because the Republicans have done anything to make themselves look good, but because Democrats have, according to public polling, have not done a good job. The president's polling numbers seem to slide every day. His approval rating right now is about 36% among national polls. That's the lowest among modern presidents. And typically, voters, undecided voters or party or voters who don't have an allegiance to either party, will usually vote for the party other than the president's party if they're unhappy with the president. And we see that this is very likely to happen this year. Most of those independent voters who are neither strongly Republican nor Democratic, particularly women in the suburban areas, seem to be very likely to vote Republican this year. And I expect the Republicans to win back control of the House by a comfortable margin. In the Senate, it's about a 50-50 chance that Republicans will regain control of the Senate. There is a 50-50 split right now, but there are a lot of Republican senators retiring from states that are going to be very competitive, like Missouri, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Ohio. And the Republican candidates really haven't made a lot of gains, and it's possible that Democrats could win some of those seats. So at least the House of Representatives will flip to Republican control. The Senate is still in question, but Republicans seem to gain a little momentum each week. And the key thing to watch is the president's approval rating. If they stay below 40%, then the Senate is likely to flip to Republican control. If they creep above 40%, then maybe the Senate will stay in Democratic hands. But the Republicans are clearly ready to take the majority in the House.
Well, John, you know, we have a pretty educated client base, but what does that mean? You know, what can you get done? Let's just say the Republicans took both houses, you know, the Senate and the House. What can they get done? I mean, there's vetoes. Do they have any power? What would that look like?
Yeah, so if Republicans controlled the House and Senate, and you have President Biden in the White House for either his last 2 years or the last 2 years of his first term, both sides would have to decide that they want to be bipartisan in order to expect any kind of big bipartisan legislation to pass. So the question is that likely to happen? Is Biden likely to become more bipartisan? Are Republican leaders in the House and Senate likely to want to become more bipartisan? My guess is that they are not. And they would be willing to be bipartisan on issues that are national crises or emergencies, like we saw with support for Ukraine this year. That was really an emergency where the two parties rallied together. Something like that would probably command bipartisan support. But really, what I think you'll see in 2023, in 2024 in Washington is a desire by Republicans to pass bills that they like in an effort to show voters what they're for and what they would likely pass if they held the presidency after 2024. So you'll see a lot of bills passed that would be vetoed by the president. So a lot of kind of wasted exercise in legislation to pass bills that ultimately won't become law. The president would not work on legislation so much. He would work more on regulation, on executive orders, on things that he can do on his own through the executive branch that Congress doesn't need to weigh in on and provide help, such as trade, foreign policy. Those are things where the president really has a free hand to do what he wants. Also, regulations. This administration believes that the previous administration cut too much regulation. It wants to impose new regulation. I see it all the time in my sector, in the financial services sector. So they would continue to work on that, particularly in the climate area, where they would try to do some things on climate change. So I think that we would see kind of a deadlock in Washington in 2023 and 2024. Both parties would try to do things to position themselves to be more attractive to voters in the 2024 presidential election.
John, before we get to the 2024, so the president would use executive orders. Does Congress, if they had both parties, just say they had the Senate and the House, the Republicans, can they do anything about that, or does that all have to be blocked by the courts?
Well, it can be blocked by the courts, and many regulations that the president proposes will be challenged in court, which will have the effect of delaying them until court action decides in whatever way it does. The Congress can overturn regulation, but it requires a significant vote. Like in the Senate, it would require 60 votes to pass. And it's very unlikely that Republicans will have close to 60 votes in any new configuration of the Senate in 2023. If they have a majority, it'll likely be 51 or 52 seats, maybe at the most 53, but not close to 60. So I don't think Congress, even though they have the ability, I don't think that they'll have the numbers. They'll have the level of support needed to pass bills overturning new regulations. When they fund the government each year, they may include provisions that deny funding for the implementation of certain regulations. That's a possible way to also suck the life out of regulations. That will be an option that they consider late in 2023. But remember, the president can veto those as well. So that could be the source of a standoff between Republicans and Democrats when they go through their annual process of funding government, which is really the only thing they have to do every year. They don't have to pass a lot of laws. They cannot pass anything, but they do have to pass a bill funding the government if they want government to function. So this exercise will afford Republicans an opportunity to cut regulations that the Biden administration has proposed, but they're probably very limited to only a couple or to one or two, if that. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, hopefully we don't get a bunch of shutdowns. That kind of sets it up for your thoughts on the 2024 presidential election. What are you thinking on that? I'll just let you talk.
Yeah, well, it could be a very disciplined election in the sense of the two parties rallying behind two people, President Trump on the Republican side, President Biden on the Democratic side. I don't think it will work that way. I think that President Biden will very, very likely not seek reelection. I know he has said that he will seek reelection, and maybe he believes that he will at this time. But I think as we get closer to the election, I don't think that he will make the decision to run. I think that he knows that, you know, he will be 82 years old at that point. We've seen evidence of his age in his performance. I'm not knocking him for that. I think when people get to be 80, 81, 82, things happen, and they happen to different people in different ways. So it doesn't affect everyone, but we're certainly seeing signs of his older age. And I think that he knows that. And I think that he will not run. He has to say he is going to run because people would otherwise just ignore him over the next couple of years. They wouldn't take him seriously. They wouldn't feel a need to really, Democrats in particular, wouldn't feel a need to to be loyal to him. So I don't think he will run. Former President Trump, I think, would like to run. I'm not sure whether he will run. I think he will run. But more people I talk to in Washington, including some closer to Trump than I am, believe that he won't run. So it's an open question. And my guess is that eventually Trump will make the decision not to run, although he may make a more public decision to announce his intention to run earlier. But when it comes time to 2024, my guess is that there's a chance he won't run. So let's say that both don't run, both Biden and Trump don't run. You'll have a wide open competition in both parties. It'll be very similar to Republicans who ran in 2016 and Democrats who ran in 2020. The field will be large. 15 or so people will run, some of whom will be candidates who ran in the last election or in 2016. Some of them will be names that people are not familiar with. I think there's a sense in both parties that voters would like to see someone new. So this gives a better chance for Democratic candidates, perhaps like a Cory Booker from New Jersey or a Governor Roy Cooper from North Carolina. Maybe on the Republican side, a Governor Ron DeSantis has kind of emerged as someone who a lot of people like, but also a more obscure senator from South Carolina, Senator Tim Scott, African-American Republican senator, has a very different profile from some of the others. So people like that could be much more prominent in the next election. If Trump does run on the Republican side, then a lot of those candidates will not run, but he will still face some competition in the primary from some people who didn't necessarily object to Trump's policies while he was president, but they objected to his temperament, to his personality, to his style. They thought that he should be more of a leader in terms of uniting the country. So there will be Republicans looking for someone other than Trump. And my guess is you'll see a spirited Republican primary election, regardless of whether Trump runs or not. But Democrats are going to have their work cut out for them to turn this ship around. Right now, the president is not popular. They'll have to turn that sentiment around if they're going to be competitive in 2024.
I'm curious, the people that said they didn't think that Trump would ultimately run, maybe he will announce something, but what's their rationale, John? Any comment on that?
Yeah, most of them cite his age. Now, Trump is, I think he's 75 or so. I may be wrong by a year or so. But Trump seems to be a very youthful 75. I don't think he's had any kind of serious medical issues, but the guy is, you know, he doesn't exercise, he doesn't eat well. I don't know if that seemingly hasn't made him too vulnerable from a health perspective, but it could catch up with him at some point. So some people cite the fact that he's going to be older and at the end of his first term, he would be over 80. So some people cite that that might not appeal to him. Others say that he wants to be kingmaker more than he wants to be king. He wants to kind of anoint who Republicans nominate rather than be the actual candidate. He likes that role more than he would serving as president. Some others, in a more cynical way, suggest that he fears losing and he doesn't want to lose, and that would bother him personally, and he doesn't want to go out on that note, although he did lose in 2020. And that would be, if he didn't run, that would be the political note that he left out on. So I don't know. I think that right now he believes he wants to run. He's kind of teasing Republican voters into thinking that he is going to run. That may be an effort just to kind of freeze the field, but it's just unclear whether he is going to run or not.
Okay. Good note. Last thing on that presidential 24. Any of the outside Democrats, any of these billionaires that you think have a chance, somebody that you might have heard on the peripheral?
Yeah, you know, you don't really hear any business people or outsiders being discussed as potential Democratic candidates. There were a couple who ran the last time, didn't really have any success. So I think that one of the other names to watch would be Senator Amy Klobuchar, who ran the last time. She ran a pretty good race, started off as a very obscure senator, attracted enough support to be noticed and to be proud of. Once she left the office, no one gave her much of a chance, and she ended up in the final four. She seems to be someone who doesn't generate as much controversy as the other Democratic candidates. She might appear to voters to be the most normal and the least radical of the Democratic candidates, and therefore she might be attractive as the race begins in earnest in 20, you know, after the midterm election. So I think she's a name to watch. I think most of the people whose names you've never heard of will be mostly people from the progressive wing of the party who won't have much of a chance, but want to make a point.
John, as we're getting toward the end here, I want to do a little turnaround here and talk about what should the investors be focused on. Is there anything up there that is game changer possibilities as far as legislation, executive action, any of that stuff?
Well, the biggest thing, tax increases, which were floated a year and a half or 2 years ago. You might remember that the original version of the Build Back Better bill, which is now coming to some kind of conclusion, the original version had tax increases on capital gains, changes to the estate tax, elimination of stepped-up basis, increase in the corporate rate. Those are all off the table. If Congress goes into Republican hands next year, then they'll be off the table for the next 2 years. So the good news is you'll probably see, investors will see no tax increases over the next 3 years, which I think is something that people should feel relaxed about. There might be a bill emerge later this year that could involve extending the age of required minimum distributions. That's something to watch. We're going to write about that in our Washington Weekly that will go out today that you will see, John, and certainly we can add any clients to that list as well. But we think that's something that will happen by the end of the year. RMD ages will go up gradually over the next 5 years. I think, you know, the market, I'm not a market expert, but I think there's just so much going on around the world that the market's really going to be volatile over the next year. And I'll just give you two things that I think people are paying much less attention to than they should. One is Ukraine. You know, it's not on the front page of the newspaper anymore. It's not the lead story. So anyone who consumes news is not seeing much of Ukraine. And that's unfortunate because it might mean that the Western coalition that has defended Ukraine and aided Ukraine might falter a little bit. You might see some less of a commitment to Ukraine. You might see more Russian gains. But there will be big offensives in the fall, as Ukraine gets better U.S. military, particularly longer range rocket launchers, there will be offenses that Ukraine makes. There'll be counteroffenses by Russia. So the war is going to grow in intensity in the fall, and that may spook the markets depending on what happens. We may see good developments if Ukraine makes progress in reclaiming some territory. We may see some worsening of the situation if Russia takes over more land. The second thing is Russia's playing around with their supplies of natural gas that they're under contract to supply to European countries for this upcoming winter. 40% of European gas comes from Russia. Most of Europe and Russia are now at odds over the war. Will Russia limit those gas supplies to those European nations? Will Europe have a rough winter because they don't have enough gas to heat their homes and businesses? Will that throw Europe into recession? Will that adversely affect the growth that we've seen in Europe that could throw the U.S. into a recession? Those are big things to watch. And again, I'm not an expert in the markets or whether we're going to have a recession or not, but I certainly see geopolitical factors as contributing to some market volatility in the last quarter of the year that doesn't exist today. So those are a couple things to watch. They're both kind of related, but I certainly have my eye on those as we get home from summer vacation and get into the fall and winter seasons.
Any last thoughts, John?
Well, my last thought would be that anytime your clients need anything from Washington or need anything from me, they should let you know and we'll try to help them. Your clients should consider me a part of your team and we're here to help. So if there's anything in Washington we can do other than pass good laws and try to make everyone happy, which is a full-time job, I'm around to do it.
John, we really appreciate your time with us today. Now, if anyone listening would like to subscribe to the Washington Weekly newsletter that John and his team come out with, feel free to reach out to us or James, and we'll get you on that newsletter subscription list. And also, this podcast, this call is recorded as a podcast, and it can be found on Apple Podcast app here in about a week. And it also has our other recordings from previous speakers. And this is going to be the end of the call. And John, I want to thank you again for spending time with us today.
Sure. Thank you. Hope everyone has a good weekend.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye now.